You don't sound like my brother.
Oh, hum, I'm Dan.
Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger or disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm your host, John McCoy. And with me is first-time co-host, Audrey Lazaro. Did I have your last name right?
Depending on who I'm speaking to and what language, I say it both ways, Lazaro and Lazaro, so yes.
Well, Audrey, I know you very well, but the audience out there might not know you, so why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Audrey Lazaro, and I know John through his brother Dan, who I am married to, and, you know, maybe I'm going to try getting into the podcasting business, who knows?
So this time, we are doing a piece that you suggested, which is actually a piece that's been on my list for a very long time, Herman Melville's Bartleby the Scrivener. From 1853, it actually has a subtitle, A Story of Wall Street. And of all the stories you could have done, why did you choose this one?
Well, that's because I didn't know I was pitching ideas for what I would talk about. I was just like, oh, these are stories that I remember from reading them in school. And this one sticks with me because I just don't get it. I remember reading it and I remember liking it, but not knowing why, being really frustrated, like, I don't understand this man. And I guess that's what sticks with everyone, right? It's just a very ambiguous story.
Did you read this in high school or did you read it in college?
I was trying to remember. I think I read it in high school. It's hard to say. It all mixes together. I took a lot of, you know, as an accounting major, I took a lot of short story classes. So this could have been one of them. But it's within maybe the later years of high school, early college. Definitely for school. This is my first Melville, well, only Melville work I've read. I've never read Moby Dick. I've tried, but I'm like, oh, this is really long. I'll get to it later.
Well, I would say listen to the podcast that Glenn Fleischman and I recorded about Moby Dick, except that will just convince you that it's that Moby Dick is longer than anything else. I think that podcast ran about 2 hours. Yeah, so I read Bartleby the Scrivener in grad school in a course on 19th century American literature, and that was a lot of Melville in that class. We read Moby Dick, we read Bartleby, we read a very strange story, Benito Cereno, and we read Billy Budd, which was his last work, which was, I believe, unfinished at his death. And we read a bunch of poetry. So by the end of the semester, I was all Melville'd out. But as with you, this story wormed its way into my head. It's a strange story, and I don't think anyone who's read it will probably forget it.
Would you say it's one of his most frustrating stories that you've read?
Well, you know, I haven't read so many of them, but what I will say is I agree with you that it is a story that defies easy interpretation. I think that that's typical of Melville. If you ever read Moby Dick, it is a book that you can interpret any number of ways. And this story, I think, is something of a Rorschach test. What you think it's about has a lot to do with, I think, who you are.
Yeah, it's it's like one of those things. Do you see an old lady or a young woman?
I'm going to give a little bit of context here for the story. Herman Melville actually started out as a very popular writer. He wrote a book that isn't read much today called Tipe, which is about sailing in Polynesia. And he wrote a sequel called Umu, and those were both enormously popular. They were like just what the 19th century audiences wanted. They were adventurous. They were about travel to faraway lands. They were white people feeling smug and superior because all those crazy people living in islands were so different from them. And then Melville started to get ambitious and wanted to write other things and wanted to write difficult things. And as he went on, his publishers became more and more upset with him to the point where when he wrote Moby Dick in 1851, it was an enormous commercial flop. And in fact, Moby Dick did not become the great American novel that it is until much later, when it was rediscovered in the 20th century. I think it's like around 1911 or something like that.
That it makes me so sad too, because I read a little bit of that, and that he just didn't find his success again after his earlier success. And if he only knew.
Yeah, it's a good question. What would have happened if he had known? A lot of what draws people to Melville is his incredibly ironic take on things. And so maybe if he had had more financial success, he would have been, you know, a happy writer, and we would have had just a bunch of, Dan Brown novels from him or something like that.
I actually, last night I watched a very bad movie called Not Another Happy Ending, which is about an author, Karen Gillian. And she's an author that wrote this huge successful debut novel. And then her life started getting better. And so her publisher, who's also secretly in love with her, thought that she wouldn't be able to finish her book. So he was trying to actively make her life miserable so she could finish her second book. Not a great idea. I think there's that myth that you have to be miserable, and that keeps you hungry as an artist. But I don't know how much I believe it.
After Moby Dick, he wrote his strangest novel of all, which is called Pierre or the Ambiguities. And part of what makes it a strange novel, aside from the fact that it has a lot of weird Freudian sexuality in it, is that halfway through the novel, it becomes a extended parody of the American publishing system at the time. Because Melville was having a miserable time with his publisher, and so he decided to roast his publisher in his book. And back in the 90s, when I was taking this class, there was a new edition of Pierre that just came out, and the editor decided he wanted to take out all that from the book, because he said, that's just incidental to the fact that Melville was having a bad time, and it ruins the effect of the book. And I was like, how do you make that decision?
That's funny. In this story, he references a murder, Colt and Adams, I guess that's towards the middle of it, when he was getting really frustrated with Bartleby. He references Colt and Adams, and I looked it up because I've never heard of it. And it was it was about one of the brothers. So the cult is of the gun manufacturing fame. I think it was his brother. And then the publisher. I'm trying to see where this actual passage is. Hold on. Yeah, and he starts talking about what a sad occurrence it was. Adams was the publisher, and Colt killed him in this. He said it was self-defense, but he owed the publisher money. And when he was talking about it, he was like, I feel bad for both of them, the narrator. It's like, I feel bad for both of them, but especially the guy who owed money and, like, killed the guy. Like, oh, obviously, he has a ton of guilt about this. So it really is a... It shows his views on publishers and what he thinks of them.
And some people think that's a key to understanding this story. Some people will say this is Melville's response to his publisher who wants him to write another bestseller. That seems a little facile to me, but that is one interpretation people make of this story. So this is the story of the titular Bartleby the Scrivener. A scrivener being someone who writes things out in longhand to keep records for various professional people. You know, in a pre-printing, a pre-typewriter society, and in a society where a lot of people might not be literate or at least might not have good handwriting, scriveners were valued for their speed and for the elegance of their writing. And it's interesting because, you know, the other thing you might think of when you think of a scrivener is you might think of a clerk, you know, like Bob Cratchit in the Christmas Carol. But a clerk indicates that someone who might be keeping, not just doing the writing for an office, but also keeping the books for an office. Out of that arose sort of the accounting class as a professional class that pulled away from this more, you know, clerical group of people. But the other thing that I think is really funny is if you look at this story, the unnamed narrator, who is a very businessy lawyer, by which I mean he never actually tries cases. You know, he just works behind the scene, writing contracts and poring over other people's contracts.
Yeah, I think he says something like he wants it easy. This is easy money. This is like he likes the path of least resistance, and this feels like it for him.
This lawyer has three scriveners in his employ when it starts, and they're all men. And by the time the typewriter gets invented, one of the things that the typewriter companies did to try and get professionals to buy a typewriter was you bought a typewriter and it came with a typist. And a lot of the early typewriter companies trained women to type.
Oh, wow.
And it was like, hey, you get one of our typewriters, you also get this pretty young woman who will type for you. And
that's wild.
and that's in some ways one of the basis of why secretaries in the 20th century became a female job, and that became associated with women, and in some ways devalued. So that's a little bit of trivia there. I was in fact a administrative assistant when I was in grad school for a department, and I insisted that people call me a secretary because I thought that was only fair.
When was this, you said?
This was in 91, 92.
Did you have to do a lot of typing for your job?
I had to write letters for the the director of the program I was working for. I had to keep, I had to keep a lot of records on, it was an academic department, and I had to keep records on what classes were being taught by whom and that sort of thing.
That sounds not fun.
Well, we all start somewhere. But the other thing that strikes me about this, the beginning, is Melville spends a long time introducing these three other Scriveners, and they are they're kind of eccentric, nutty characters. They all have crazy names. There's Turkey, the oldest one, who is in his 50s or 60s. There's Nipper, who is in his 20s. And there is Gingernut, who's just a kid.
I took a quiz. So I was, it really felt like school. So I read this story, and then I read Slate has annotations. So then I read those, and then I went to see what Cliff Notes exist online. And then they have a quiz at the end of it. I'm like, oh, this will be fun. And one of the questions was, what are the names of the three workers in the office? And the names are so ridiculous that it would have been hard. If you didn't actually read the story and you're trying to figure out what their real names are, the real names are as ridiculous as all the fake names. So you would never be able to get it right. Because it's just, such expressive, really absurd names that he gave these three. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, you are.
Along with the three employees he had, I feel like he spent a lot of time describing this terrible-sounding office. There's a lot of time spent on just... It's like a long office with a separating... glass enclosure between where the lawyer sits and the three of them sit, and windows that face nothing.
In some ways, Melville is winding us up here to think this is going to be a sort of a jocular, gentle parody of office life. And these names seem to be names out of Charles Dickens or something like that. And in fact, it reminds me of a class of office workers who have silly stories you can tell about them. And in fact, it opens with the narrator saying, I've seen much that could make a sentimental man cry and a happy man chuckle or whatever. You think it's going to be a very light story, and you also think that these three characters are going to be major players in the story.
Yeah, it's really front loaded with these three characters, and then towards the end you really don't get a sense for them and how they react to things anymore. I feel it's like sometimes I think of the two characters, especially Turkey and Nippers, when you create a character in a video game or something and you only have a certain amount of points to spend. And so he created two characters that's they're both terrible in different ways, but I don't get both of them being terrible at the same time. It's at different times, so I could put up with it.
Now I want to see the video game for Bartleby the Scrivener. I'm picturing it as a JRPG.
I feel like it would be a missed game where if there's not a lot of action going on, a lot of walking around.
Right, you're walking around trying to find the code in one place so you can enter it into the clock somewhere on the other side of the office.
But it actually, nothing works, and it just drives you insane.
Yeah, well, so this is the world of this story, and as we've said, the lawyer is pleased to be working in a job that is easy and unglamorous, and if the three characters show us anything, they show us that Ginger Nut does not have much of a future ahead of him, because poor Turkey is still here at 50, 60 years. He hasn't really advanced much. And that's the funny thing about this class of workers. They are adjacent to money. They are adjacent to professionalism, but they are not, they are not professionals themselves.
Yeah, this is one of the major, that's one of the reads of this story, I guess, is the, you know, the, it is a Wall Street story, right? And so it's about, it's criticism of the working, the way the working class is treated. And from certain things I've read, I think that's a major, like, writing in John Astor is just depicting this kind of wealth that is gross, and even at the time he was the symbol of, you know, this tremendous amount of wealth that one person should not have. And also, I guess they said Trinity Church is the same thing. It was a representation of just the, I think they owned a lot of real estate downtown back then. So that and Astor. And so that's why I think a popular read of this story is criticism. And, you know, like these guys who can't make that much. I think Turkey can't afford a nice coat, and so the lawyer feels bad for him and tries to give him one.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a good point to make. One of the things that I think of when I see that this was published in 1853, this is, you know, this is 7 years before the Civil War begins. And the after the Civil War is when you see that enormous explosion of new wealth that was out there. You know, I don't know. Did you watch the series The Gilded Age when it was on?
No, I did not.
No.
But that looks great.
Yeah. Well, that whole, all the railroad tycoons, all the robber barons and stuff, those come in the 1870s, 1880s. This is New York. Right before the Civil War, everything here is old money and everything is stagnant. You know, nobody's, there's no social ladder. Nobody's going anywhere. So that's why I do think it is a criticism of perhaps the social order and of wealth, but it's not the super wealthy New Yorkers like Rockefeller that are going to be coming down the line in another 20, 30 years.
If they only knew. If they only knew what were to come with, you know, the people we have now.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, God. Well, so into this mess, our narrator decides he needs yet another scrivener. And he hires Bartleby, who shows up, and Bartleby is morose and forlorn, and he doesn't seem to have much of a life outside of the office. And as the story goes on, we learn that's true in an alarming way. He also doesn't seem to eat anything except for what, with ginger nuts.
I think it's so funny that, like, this story is so absurd and so much of it's so funny. And the lawyer is like, you know, I have these two employees that are great sometimes, but other times terrible. It's like, oh, I have this nice, quiet guy and really banked on this guy. And it's like, oh, it's perfect. I could have him on my side of the room. He won't disturb me. And, you know, whenever I need him, he could hear me, even if my door is closed. This will be great. And it's like, little did he know he picked the worst one.
Right. So Bartleby starts out as, you know, the model employee in that he does everything. He doesn't complain. He doesn't ask for anything. But eventually things start to go south when the lawyer asks him to proofread some of the documents, which is apparently the longest and most tedious part of being a scrivener, is going over these documents. And in fact, you know, when I was looking up my own research, I found that there is a thing called, there's a term in the law called the scrivener's error, which is when a contract is invalidated because of an error in transcription. So it's not invoked much anymore, but still people can like make, if you make a typo, you know, that changes at some point of the contract, that can become a problem. So obviously a lawyer, especially one who deals in business law, has to go over all these documents with a fine-tooth comb.
Yeah, reading this now, it's hard to imagine, and you don't think about it, but it's like, oh, yeah, you do need to have all of your people sit down at the same time, read it while you're reciting what it should say to make sure all of the copies say the same thing, because it was all by hand.
Yeah, yeah. So it's now that Bartleby utters the famous line that everyone will remember from this short story, "I would prefer not to."
I love it. It's just so much funnier now too. Like when I was younger, I was more mad. For people who don't know me, I'm a Filipino American who was born here but went back to the Philippines as soon as I was born, and I came back when I was 6. And so I come from a family of immigrants, very practical people, I think. And there's this idea, like, what do you mean you prefer not? Everyone prefers to not. You still do. Like, I don't understand this.
Right. Well, you've put your finger on one of the reasons why this is such a hard story to interpret, because I think Melville really, really carefully chose this whole line, every word in that sentence, very well, because you might expect Bartleby to just say no, or say, I won't do that, or let me do something else. This whole, the strange, distinct politeness of this, I would prefer not to. He's not saying he's not going to. Of course, he won't. He never does. But he doesn't say he's not going to. He says it's a preference. And it appeals to he's appealing to the narrator's sense of not wanting to put Bartleby out, I guess.
Yeah, I think the way it's said, like, I prefer not to, it shows that the transaction is two ways, right? Like, he's not saying directly he will not do it, but preferring not to means that you also have a say in it, and it's making you a more active participant in trying to get him to do a thing, if that makes sense.
No, yeah, it's a very good point, Audrey. I think that what makes this so shocking to the narrator is nobody expects someone lower down in a hierarchy to be able to refuse a request. The idea, the very thought that anyone would presume to refuse a request is absurd to the lawyer. That's not the way he sees the social contract working. So the fact that Bartleby, as you say, proposes a two-way arrangement, drives the narrative crazy.
You don't really get a sense of what Bartleby's thinking, but you get so much of what the narrator is thinking and the bargains he makes with himself, the way he's angry one moment and he's like, he's very sympathetic the next, and he's like, oh, you know, of course you would prefer not to, and takes pity on him instead. And it's all of these interpretations he's making in his head, the hoops he's jumping through to, like, make these mental connections to translate what that means to him.
Also, the narrator has to worry about how Bartleby's dereliction of duty is going to affect the other scriveners in the office, who are quite incensed by the fact that they have to do work that Bartleby doesn't do. In fact, Nippers keeps, doing the sort of let me at him thing, like, shall I darken his eyes, or shall I black his eye? It's you know what's so funny about that for me is that Nippers and Turkey and Gingernut continue to be comical characters from a Victorian novel, and Bartleby is coming in out of another place entirely. He's inscrutable. He's not funny. At least he's not trying to be funny. He's not going to give the narrator anything, and he's not going to give the reader anything. And it reminds me of, like, when you watch an old film where Marlon Brando shows up or something like that, and he's just, like, acting in a completely different style from everyone around him. You watch, like, On the Waterfront or something like that, and there's people still acting like they're in the 1930s, 1940s. Here comes Brando, and he's, like, mumbling, and he's doing that whole method acting thing, and, like, it's like you're watching two different movies, or Norman Bates. When you see Norman Bates come into Psycho, it's just a completely different world.
I know you were talking about Marlon Brando, the actor, but that whole statement also applies to Marlon Brando in Twin Peaks. did you watch The Return, where what's his name? Is it Shia LaBeouf? Comes in as a character named Marlon Brando and is straight out of like motorcycle gang from the 30s. And it's like, where did this guy come from? I guess I didn't understand that joke until now.
Bartleby, as you said, Bartleby doesn't give any reason for what he does, but he continues to refuse to do anything. And we see the narrator go through all kinds of mental gymnastics at first, bemused, sometimes angry, sometimes determined that he's going to fire Bartleby. And he tries at one point to fire Bartleby and says, you need to leave here within whatever a week, and I will write you a letter of recommendation. And to that, Bartleby also says he would prefer not to.
But I just want to note how he says it at least a couple of times. He says that Bartleby should quit him. So again, it's this weird gymnastics of who is taking what action. So he is trying to get Bartleby to be the one to quit him. And he also just doesn't have the heart to be like, no, leave. You have to leave. And that, again, as a kid, was really frustrating to me. It's like, this is a bad boss. Everyone, even in the beginning, Turkey and Nippers, he says that there are certain times when he wants to get rid of them, but they convince him. It's like, oh, no, it's not that big of a deal. And he's like, yeah, they're right. It's not that big of a deal. And Bartleby just, you know, walks all over him to the point where he's like, I can't get rid of this guy. I just have to leave, and like slowly backs out of his office. And, you know, as a teen, I was not 5 years old reading Bartleby. Yeah, I thought, it's like, what a bad boss this guy is.
Well, that's an interesting take, because that's the other thing about the whole workplace arrangement, is it's supposed to just be about business, and it's supposed to be that the boss is going to judge you upon your ability to do the tasks put before you, on your value to the organization, and not to consider things like, does this person have a home? Does this person have, you know, kids? Or is this person going through a difficult point in their life? And that is, in some ways, the dehumanizing nature of work for hire. Bartleby puts the narrator into this uncomfortable position of considering what could possibly have brought his scrivener to this state. We learn that he's living in the office, for example. In fact, when the narrator comes in the morning, he knocks on the door and Bartleby says, wait, I'm still busy. So the narrator can't even get into his office of a morning.
It's funny, because if I think about the narrator, he wants to be charitable, but I think it is hard for him to be more charitable because Bartleby is so himself, so sure of himself. He is the one saying, no, you have to leave, walk around the block a couple of times and come back, and maybe, you know, I'll be ready then. I'm not ready now. And that's just a position he's not used to. And so he wants to be charitable, but it also angers him.
So, as you say, the narrator decides on the brilliant plan that he's going to move his offices, and he's just going to leave Bartleby where he is.
That is so funny.
It seems like an Edward Gorey story at that point, or something like that. But he does leave, only for like a week later, someone shows up at his new offices and says, hey, did you leave a scrivener in our office? And what is this guy doing? And why is he hanging around there? He's just like sitting on the, like the banisters or something like that.
Yeah. And even as he left, he has to take care of this guy, because he is the one that has tried the hardest at this point. I really loved all of this middle, this, I guess it's not the middle, it's almost the end of the story. Well, it's before the sad part of the story. So, you know, it's definitely to me the best part, where he just doesn't know what to do. And I think it was a sign of defeat, not charity, to be like, do you want to come stay at my house and we could sort this out? And even that, he was like, no, I would prefer to stay here.
It is ironic, in a way, that the narrator is the one who's trying to find a solution that might include such radical things as crossing social lines and bringing Bartleby home with him. And Bartleby is immovable, not just from his desire to not do anything, but literally immovable. He will not leave this office space. He's sort of become a fixture in the office space, and he had, you know, as far as we know, he never goes outside or does anything else.
Yeah, so we mentioned how this, some have interpreted this to be autobiographical in some way because of where Melville was in his life, how he felt about, like, as a copyist and maybe, like, as somebody who had success with these adventure stories earlier. And his publishers were like, do that again. And he didn't want to. And so this "I prefer not to" could be applied to him. I understand that and I see that, but I find it strange that if that's the reading, he made himself so unknown to us and not necessarily a sympathetic figure at all times. Like, at a lot of times, it's more of a frustrating character that we have to deal with. And so I find that interesting, where it's like, I see how it could be him, but I also, if that is him, that's a really strange way to depict yourself for people.
Bartleby is so impenetrable for a reader. And I think that some people like to see this story as a story about labor revolting against management, you know, Marxist sort of, you know, labor versus capital sort of reading. But the trouble with that reading is there's nothing that Bartleby does that's particularly heroic. And it's not as though his actions, his inaction is going to make his life better or anyone's life better. It's not as though Bartleby ultimately affects any change in the world. In fact, all he does is slowly render himself immobile. And because of that, I think some people will also see Bartleby as being clinically depressed in a time before there was a clear understanding of depression. Melville is writing about someone who has become unable to function because of his lack of affect or his lack of motivation. And that, you know, that's one other way of reading it. That's a very naturalistic way of reading it. But I don't feel like that's correct either. I think that that doesn't go along with the weird jocularity of the story, or, you know, it has this very odd ending.
He tries to help him. Bartleby wouldn't move, and he ends up in the tombs, which are prisons, right? So, and then he just ends up dying there, even at the prison, the narrator is trying to help him, trying to bribe the guy, the cook, to feed him better meals. And I think that was the only time that Bartleby said something that was definitive, not what he would prefer not to do. Right? Do you have that line handy by any chance, or do you know what I'm talking about?
That's the part where Bartleby is asked, wouldn't you come to eat? Wouldn't you, you know, because Bartleby isn't eating at this point. He's refused not just to do anything, but he's refusing to sustain his life at this point. The grub man, the guy that the narrator is asking to feed Bartleby, says, hope you'll stay with us sometime. To try to make it agreeable. I mean, Mrs. Cutlets and I have the pleasure of your company to dinner, sir, in Mrs. Cutlets' private room. And Bartleby says, I prefer not to dine today, said Bartleby, turning away. It would disagree with me.
It's actually a little above that, where he sees Bartleby for the first time in the tombs, and he says, Bartleby, I know you, he said without looking round, and I want nothing to say to you. So that's the first instance we get of Bartleby being definitive in his word. I guess it's surprising when you don't get anything from a character to see he understands what has happened to him. He understood the whole time what was happening to him, and he wants not, like, I want nothing to do with you. And so he feels aggrieved by this man who sent him to prison, essentially.
Right. No, that's a great point. And when the narrator is trying to make a connection, and he's saying, nothing reproachful attaches to you by being here, and see, it is not so sad a place as one might think. Look, there's the sky, and here's the grass. I know where I am, he replied, but would say nothing more. He is indicating absolute awareness of everything that's been going on. So if you you know, if you're tempted to read up to this point that Bartleby is suffering some sort of a psychotic break with the world, I don't think that the story supports it at this point.
It really does add to the sense. It's like, okay, there is an inner world there that he understands that he is not willing to show. And right now, by saying he understands who this person is and where he is, he's just, I guess, showing anger, right? That's the only... And then it becomes not so funny and a real bummer from this point on, because he just basically wastes away and goes on a hunger strike and doesn't eat and stays in one corner until he dies.
And once he dies, there's this line where the narrator, someone asks, is he asleep? And the narrator says, with kings and counselors, which is a quote from Job. And it's such a florid way, such a Victorian way to talk about death. It's almost like the narrator is trying to provide some sort of poetic read that I, again, don't think is the right thing for Bartleby's world. Bartleby is not going to allow you to come up with any kind of pat answer for his life as much as you wanted to try. And this is the weird ending that I was going to say, is that afterwards we get this coda where the narrator says, you know, I don't know much about Bartleby, but I did learn sometime later that he had spent many years working in the post office in a dead letter department. And he says, think of the dead letter department as the place where communication goes to die. And, you know, all you do there all day long is destroy letters that will never find their recipients. And he ends with, like, ah, Bartleby, ah, the humanity, which makes me think of the Hindenburg. But... but again, it's like the narrator is so desperate to come up with an answer to Bartleby. I don't know that this answers Bartleby any more than anything else.
It's one of those things you find out. It's like, oh yes, that makes sense. But then it's only a feeling that makes sense when you try to explain it. I don't really know how to, but that adds some color, like, I don't know, a sense of loneliness. You really understand this guy lived by himself, didn't talk to his coworkers, didn't go outside, but also by choice. But this, I mean, it's such a colorful way to show, like, a one-sided communication. He used to be a dead letter office clerk. That's a real job, right? Is it still exist, or?
I think there still is a dead letter office. Probably more busy than ever now that the post office keeps getting gutted by the Postmaster General.
But then you get all
sorry to my Trump supporting audience out there.
You get these stories from time to time about people who get letters, you know, 60 years later. So maybe some of them get through.
Right. And that's in some ways, the antithesis to the story. If you think about a story like Castaway, in which Tom Cruise, you know, gets stranded on that island for all those years, and still he decides he has to deliver that one package he's got left. And we're supposed to see that as some sort of a triumph of the human spirit, that he adheres to his job and he sees his job through. You know, that's sort of the opposite of what Bartleby does. But in both cases, you know, when I liked Castaway, I think it was a good film, but I wasn't sure about that as a triumph, because I felt like, yeah, but it's been 15 years. Whatever's in that box has lost any of its.
What if it was pints of ice cream? You don't know. Happened to my friend a couple times. So the question is, are you a Bartleby or a, what's Tom Hanks's name in Castaway?
I don't know. We'll call him Mr. Castaway.
Yeah. Are you Bartleby or Castaway? There's only two types of people in life.
Yeah. Well, Castaways, wasn't that the song that everyone was singing last summer?
I don't even know.
Castaways. Look it up. It was the TikTok hit of last summer.
Oh, see, I should look it up.
So, you know, we started with you explaining how frustrated you were with interpretation of the story. And I suggested that this story frustrates interpretation. And I still, you know, I do feel that way about this. And I think that's Melville's peculiar genius is, are we supposed to see Bartleby as some sort of a romantic hero? Did he take some sort of an existential stand against a dehumanizing world? And by deciding to do nothing, was that a triumph? You know, I early on in this series, we read Robert Cormer's The Chocolate War, and that was a story about a boy who refused to take part in the school's fundraiser, which was selling chocolates. And that was supposed to be him taking a stand against what he saw as the corrupt workings of the school and the student body. And the student ends up utterly defeated at the end of that book. And there are these stories of people trying to achieve some sort of self-determination by refusing to do what they are expected of doing. I don't think it gives Bartleby anything, though. I think at the end, Bartleby becomes the victim of his own inability to do things, because as time goes on, that inability to do anything destroys him.
Yeah, I think there's so many interpretations. The one where, if you read it as semi-autobiographical, I feel is the most interesting, where you have the complexities of how you feel about yourself, and that could come with self-loathing and knowing that you wanted, you know, you're on this path that, you know, maybe isn't the best for you, but you do it anyways. But yeah, I was saying how much I was frustrated by this when I was younger, and now rereading it, I think I'm more comfortable with the unknown and more comfortable that it doesn't necessarily add up together. Again, I was an accounting major, so things being neat was pretty important to me. But I think now there's just, it's so much more interesting that you could get so much out of it. And yeah, there's a lot of humor in it, and there's a lot of sadness in it at different parts, and it all exists, and it all is there for you to pick what you want, I guess.
I think it's amazing to hear you talk about it as a story that encompasses so much, because in a way it does encompass so much. But on the other hand, it's ultimately a story about nothing happening. in a way, it's like a writer's dare. Can you write an interesting story about a character that doesn't do anything?
Yeah, it's named for Bartleby, but the most insight you get is the narrator, right? And part of it is like, I don't know why, I mean, this makes sense in my head, but I read a lot of The Atlantic's Dear Therapist advice column. And when it comes to relationships, especially with family, one of the things she writes is, you do a dance, you're used to this dance. If you change the steps of the dance, your partner has to change with you. And I think that is what happened here, where this man is used to a certain dance he has with his employees, and this one guy just defied it and was like, no, I'm not going to do that. And we then go through his process of, what do I do with myself now? I don't know where to go from here. And so it's really a story about his mental journey of what to do when you're faced with an unknown where the actions are not what you expect.
Did this make you interested in reading any more Melville, or is this like enough for you at this point?
Yeah, I think I'm interested. I mean, like I said, I've never read Moby Dick, but I know how long it is. And now I feel like my attention span is so much shorter than it used to be. But Dan was telling me how it's also really funny in some parts.
Oh, Moby Dick is hilarious, actually. I think Moby Dick has a bad reputation of being a boring book. I could read, if Melville had kept that up for another 1,200 pages, I would have read all those too, because it was just it's just amusing. But if you want to read a good Melville short story, read Benito Cereno. And I think it's a good story to read if you don't know anything about what happens in it, because it is a story that is a sort of a mystery story as to what's going on, and it ends up being a horror story at the end. And it also is a very strange reflection on slavery right on the right before the Civil War. So
That sounds cool.
Yeah, and if you like horror, it has a very horrific ending.
That's sold me. Okay.
Okay. Thanks again to Audrey. Sorry, how do you pronounce your name again?
Lazaro.
Lazaro. Man, I've been reading it Lazaro all these years, so it's Audrey, it's Lazaro. I feel like a bad brother-in-law.
Like I said, I say it both ways. It's usually, if people say it in Tagalog, it's more Lazaro, so both are right.
Well, thank you, Audrey, for being on. Say hi to Dan for me. But this is the time of the year when we remind you how you can support the podcast by becoming a member of The Incomparable. You can sign up for a monthly or annual pledge to support this podcast directly. Go to theincomparable.com/members and sign up. You can choose which shows in the network you'd like to support. If you check just the box for Sophomore Lit, your contribution will come to this podcast after a few fees are taken out. But if you listen to other podcasts on the Incomparable Network, and you really should, you can also check their boxes, and your contribution will be shared equally by all the shows you want to support. As a thank you for supporting us, members receive lots of extras. There are several exclusive podcast feeds, including an ad-free version of The Incomparable Mothership, bootlegs of live recording sessions, and a special feed full of bonus episodes that only members get to hear. New members will also receive free Incomparable swag as well. For this podcast, every year, Sophomore Lit does its mirror image, its Black Mirror image, which is I like to call landfill literature, where we look into a great trash bit of fiction. And this year, we are doing, God help me, Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code. So if you want to hear me cry on air, tune in to that special podcast available to pledgers. There are contribution levels at $5, $10, and $20 a month, and annual equivalents are available as well. If you're already a member, it's easy to increase your pledge to a higher level and get some special goodies in return, including some free Incomparable swag, too. So if you'd like to support us, go to theincomparable.com/members. But whatever you do, keep up the reading, because everything will be on the final.